You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 453, 1 Samuel 7. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how's it going?
Well, not too bad. We're recording this on the day after Thanksgiving, so hopefully everyone had a good Thanksgiving. I know we did.
Yeah, I did just come out of my food coma, so we still have leftovers, so I expect to induce another coma after this recording. Probably put me down for a couple of days, so I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. Do you have any other traditions? Like you're not doing Black Friday shopping, are you?
No Black Friday. I'm more of a Cyber Monday. If I can sit at my desk and buy something, that's more my speed. But no, we don't do any of the shopping.
I didn't even know there was Cyber Mondays. It tells you how out of the loop I am.
Yeah, and shopping's not a big tradition for us.
Yeah. Yeah, it died in our place 2 years ago. The girls used to be real into it and do crazy stuff, but they're not so much anymore.
Yeah, yeah. I guess if you need the stuff that's on sale, it's good. But it seems like just a bunch of stuff I don't need, so it's just pointless.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah.
I don't know, Mike. But, hey, what is good shopping is Logos. You got to get some Logos. Logos is graciously sponsoring us again for the next three episodes.
Oh, good.
Yeah, absolutely. So we briefly want to talk about Logos 10. Nothing beats digging into the Bible with software like Logos 10, specifically their new version. I think it just came out this year, Mike. Do you know if it just came out?
Yeah, yeah. It's not very old. The new version just recently dropped.
Yeah, so
I don't think it's been a year. No.
Yeah, so they're wanting everybody to upgrade, and you know, if you want to go beyond Bible reading and deep studying of scripture, you know, Logos 10 is where you want to be. If you want to prep a sermon or understand a passage, even start a reading plan, Mike, you can do anything and everything. And you always talk about how you need theological tools like this to go deeper than you can by yourself.
Yeah, you want a desk, an electronic desk buddy that reminds you to read through your New Testament dictionary series from InterVarsity that I'm always harping on. There you go. You just plug that thing in and it'll pop up every day reminding you to read. So you can put anything in there you want. It's a nice feature.
Absolutely. I mean, it's sleek, modern, it's fast. Logos 10. Live in the Word with Logos 10. So go visit logos.com/nakedbible to find the best Logos package for you right now. Again, go to logos.com/nakedbible. And we want to thank Logos for sponsoring the Naked Bible Podcast. We appreciate it. Well, Mike, back to 1 Samuel with chapter 7.
Yep, we are in chapter 7. That'll be the content of our episode today. When we get past chapter 7, I think I'm going to group chapters 8 through 10 and do a couple parts on them because it's all about the whole issue of kingship. You know, was it right to want a king or not, and so on and so forth. So that's going to take at least two parts. But for today, 1 Samuel 7, we have to ask, of course, you know, what the chapter is about, but I'm going to read it first as we've been doing. Again, it's not too long, so we'll take a stab at reading it. This is right after the Philistines have figured out they need to get rid of the Ark of the Covenant. The men of Kiriath Yearim came and took up the Ark of the Lord and brought it to the house of Abinadab on the hill. And they consecrated his son Eleazar to have charge of the Ark of the Lord. From the day that the Ark was lodged at Kiriath Yearim, a long time passed, some 20 years, and all the house of Israel lamented after the Lord. Samuel said to all the house of Israel, "If you are returning to the Lord with all your heart, then put away the foreign gods and the Ashtaroth from among you, and direct your heart to the Lord and serve him only, and he will deliver you out of the hand of the Philistines." So the people of Israel put away the Baals and the Ashtaroth, and they served the Lord only. Then Samuel said, "Gather all Israel at Mizpah, and I will pray to the Lord for you." So they gathered at Mizpah and drew water and poured it out before the Lord, and fasted on that day and said there, we have sinned against the Lord, and Samuel judged the people of Israel at Mizpah. Now, when the Philistines heard that the people of Israel had gathered at Mizpah, the lords of the Philistines went up against Israel. And when the people of Israel heard of it, they were afraid of the Philistines. And the people of Israel said to Samuel, "Do not cease to cry out to the Lord our God for us, that he may save us from the hand of the Philistines." So Samuel took a nursing lamb and offered it as a whole burnt offering to the Lord. And Samuel cried out to the Lord for Israel, and the Lord answered him. As Samuel was offering up the burnt offering, the Philistines drew near to attack Israel. But the Lord thundered with a mighty sound that day against the Philistines and threw them into confusion, and they were defeated before Israel. And the men of Israel went out from Mizpah and pursued the Philistines and struck them as far as below Beth-kar. Then Samuel took a stone and set it up between Mizpah and Shen and called its name Eben-Ezer, for he said, "Till now the Lord has helped us." So the Philistines were subdued and did not again enter the territory of Israel. And the hand of the Lord was against the Philistines all the days of Samuel. The cities that the Philistines had taken from Israel were restored to Israel, from Ekron to Gath, and Israel delivered their territory from the hand of the Philistines. There was peace also between Israel and the Amorites. Samuel judged Israel all the days of his life, and he went on a circuit year by year to Bethel, Gilgal, and Mizpah, and he judged Israel in all these places. Then he would return to Ramah, for his home was there, and there he also judged Israel. And he built there an altar to the Lord. So that's the content of chapter 7. What's the chapter about? Well, it should be apparent that it's about Samuel's rise as both a spiritual and military leader, in other words, a judge. He becomes Israel's judge. It says several times in the passage that he judged Israel in such and such place, such and such manner. So it's really about Samuel's growth, and there's a 20-year period in there, you know, that is sort of encapsulated in verse 2. But he becomes Israel's judge, Israel's figure, both militarily and spiritually. Unlike the house of Eli, Samuel begins revival in Israel and delivers the people from Philistine bondage. And so this transition, or what should have been a transition, to this set of conditions, and in some ways really were throughout Samuel's own lifetime. But you can already tell it was sort of meant to have, you know, to have a king transition into this, where you'd have both a spiritual and a military leader, or so we might think. And we're going to tackle this next time about the nuances between should they have asked for a king or not. And you could apply some of the same questions to should they have had judges or not. But we'll get to that next time, because it is kind of a lingering question. I think that some of the answers might surprise you. As far as the broad or wide context of 1 Samuel 7, you know, Samuel's rise to this status, chapter 7 directly continues and certifies the contrast with the house of Eli. Again, that should be no surprise. Chisholm writes, "Samuel continues contrast Eli's house 2 through 4. Israel's defeat was closely linked with the death of Eli and his sons. The text even seems to indicate that it was their sin that brought about the loss of the ark in chapter 4, verse 4. But Samuel is linked with the military success and renewed security that his mother anticipated in her Thanksgiving song back in 1 Samuel 2:10. The contrast between Samuel and Eli is facilitated by the fact that both Israel's earlier defeat and the victory described in chapter 7 occur at places named Ebenezer. Samuel's victory also foreshadows greater victories to come under the king he will anoint. Since his victory shows that he enjoys God's favor, it contributes to his credentials as the one who will anoint kings and eventually elevate David over Saul." So again, we have this kingship nuance, but this contrast nuance with the house of Eli continues on. Is kind of beating a dead horse at this point, but you know, we're going to transition here shortly with the request for kingship we'll talk about next time. Secondly, the chapter takes us directly into Canaanite religion. So that's the second wider context. The Israelites have been worshiping, and these are both plurals, the Baals and the Ashtaroth. Okay, so two groups of something, okay? The scholars theorize that the plurals either indicate local manifestations or local idols or cult centers of the god Baal and the goddess Astarte, or that the plural phrasing is a way of expressing the idea that Israel is guilty of worshiping a wide range of Canaanite deities. Most scholars are going to opt for that first option, that it's localized centers of Baal worship, localized centers, again, plural, of the worship of Astarte, which is the singular behind Ashtaroth, that plural. Now, Chisholm again writes, "The Song of Deborah depicts the Lord as sovereign over the storm as he defeats the Canaanite armies in Judges 5, 4 through 5. The Gideon account, along with its sequel about Abimelech, contains a strong anti-Baal polemic, showing how Baal is unable to fully avenge Gideon's, that is, Jerubbaal's, attack on his altar." So let me just stop there. So Chisholm's point is that the Baal polemic has begun in the book of Judges and is going to continue here in the book of 1 Samuel. He writes, "Hannah celebrates the Lord's ability to give fertility in 1 Samuel 2, 1 through 10, in terms that echo the Baal myths. This polemic against Baal culminates in 1 Samuel 7, which records how the Lord thunders in battle against his enemies. The Lord's self-revelation in the storm is particularly significant and appropriate here because the Israelites, in response to Samuel's exhortation, have just thrown away their Baal idols and renewed their commitment to the Lord in the first four verses in chapter 7. So again, Baal was a storm deity. And so we'll pick up on this a little bit later as well. When you get this storm language of Yahweh's activity in the chapter, that's a slap in the face to Baal, because he's the one that's supposed to be in control of all that. And it turns out, well, he's not. The third, again, wider aspect of this is the chapter sets up the transition to the monarchy. I'm going to quote from Cartledge here in his commentary on 1 Samuel. He writes, "This unit of text stands alone and is significant for several reasons. The arc narrative ends with 7:1, and the account of Israel's transition to a monarchy begins with 8:1. Thus, the pericope serves as a transition piece. In other words, the whole of chapter 7 is a transition. But its primary purpose is to cast Samuel in the mold of Israel's pre-monarchic judges. The text portrays Samuel as exceedingly competent in priestly, governmental, and military roles. As such, it supports the later vein of thought that Israel's demand for a king was unnecessary." Catch that point again. You can tell where Cartledge is at on should they have asked for a king. He would say it was unnecessary because judges could do this. Again, we'll have to wait till next time to get fully into it. But continuing with Cartledge here, "The text invites reflection on Yahweh's ability to protect and guide Israel without a royal intermediary, thus leading the reader to understand Samuel's dismay in the following account when the people demand a king," again, or not. That's just one perspective. As far as specific nuggets in the chapter itself, there is, of course, Samuel's rise and the revival of the nation. So that would be our first observation. The Philistine threat didn't simply vanish as Samuel grew up. It didn't end with the Ark incident. 1 Samuel 7, 1 through 2 describes a 20-year period of Philistine oppression, a period between the death of Eli and his sons, the incident of the Ark in Philistine hands, and the full accession of Samuel. Samuel was growing up during this period, and the fact that it took 20 years to see a decisive Israelite military victory over the Philistines indicates not only the dearth of leadership throughout Israel, but also that Israel was paying for its sins. It was during this period that they were worshiping the Baals and the Ashtaroth. Eventually, Israel begins to seek the Lord, and Samuel is the mediator. When Samuel asks, in verse 3, "If you are returning to the Lord with all your heart," returning is an act of repentance. So they have to begin doing that somewhere. And when Samuel detects that in the nation, he gets involved. But Yahweh's deliverance and blessing would come only over time. There was no instantaneous revival or repentance. It was gradual, again, over this period. Now, Hoffner, in his commentary, writes of verses 1 and 2, those verses comments about the ark, he adds this thought. "By Yahweh's choice, the ark continued to reside in the Canaanite city of Kiriath Yearim in the neutral zone. The Israelites were not yet spiritually fit for Yahweh's ark to dwell among them, and they would not be until David brought it up to Jerusalem. Repentance and reform of their lives was needed, And this was the task of the prophet, the priest, and the judge, Samuel. Now, eventually, all the house of Israel, the text says, begins lamenting the lack of Yahweh's presence among them. The ark was in Kiriath-Yearim. It's no longer in Shiloh. Shiloh had lost the divine presence, and so there was no central worship center. Remember, the rest of the tabernacle was most likely there. So the ark and the tabernacle were now separated. This was an unfortunate circumstance, even if the earlier years had meant suffering under the corrupt house of Eli. At least they had both the tabernacle and the ark there. Samuel discerns the wide change of heart in the people and so issues the call of 1 Samuel 3 and 4. But it's one thing to want restoration of a relationship with Yahweh and to have one. First, they had to turn from the gods they were guilty of worshiping. So they had two tasks. They had to remove the images and the idols, you know, pagan deities in the land, and they had to turn their heart toward the Lord exclusively. So here we have, in my view, another illustration of the believing loyalty pattern once again. One cannot just say words without wanting, you know, about wanting the Lord without showing one's loyalty to, you know, one's having decision to worship only the Lord. I mean, you have, those two things have to be married. You have to act on what it is you say you believe. So I think, again, this is another good illustration of it. Hoffner writes, if the command, quote, remove from among you, unquote, were to be fully implemented, it would require the conquest of the Canaanite cities that remained on the fringes of the tribal territories, including Kiriath-Yearim, where Israelites like Abinadab lived alongside Canaanites. But apparently Samuel had a more limited, realistic goal in mind. Removing all traces of pagan worship from the communities presently under Israelite control. This holds an important lesson for Christians today. Our social goals may include bringing the laws of our lands into harmony with biblical standards, but in order to have the spiritual power to accomplish this end, we must first give attention to the injustice and dishonesty in our own households and our own church communities. You know, I thought that was well said, so I decided to include, I don't know where, you know, what eschatological stripe Hoffner was. Again, he was a Hittite scholar at the University of Chicago for many years and was an evangelical. But beyond that, I don't know where he was at eschatologically. But might sound post-mill, who knows? But it's still, I think it's still worth pointing out, again, that you had to be consistent in the house of the Lord first and then your own communities. Secondly, second nugget here, second observation, let's talk about the Baals and the Ashtaroth. And honestly, we're going to spend a good amount of time on this because it's kind of confusing. And it's confusing because the biblical data aren't consistent on it. And the biblical data outside the Bible aren't consistent on it either as to what these terms meant. Because there's a wide range of things that could be in view. And we just don't exactly know which things are in view when. So both of these terms, you know, deserve some commentary. The term Baal, is an epithet that became recognized as a proper name. Okay, so Baal initially meant Lord or Master, that eventually becomes a proper name, the god Baal. This was the chief epithet of the Canaanite storm god Hadu or Hadad. Hence, you'll find Baal Hadad in certain texts, both biblically and outside. One could refer to the same entity by either Baal or Hadu, Hadad, and people would understand who was the referent. Most scholars see the plural as referring to localized Baal cults throughout the land, scattered here and there. We commented on that earlier. Biblical Ashtaroth here in 1 Samuel 7, 3 and 4 is also a plural form. Again, if you had Hebrew, you would know that instantly because of the way the noun ends with the O-T-H. This is also a plural form. The singular in Canaanite would be Ashtart. In Greek, that is Astart. But the Masoretic Hebrew, in the Hebrew Bible, lemma in the singular is neither of those. It's Ashtoret instead of the expective Ashteret. There's a scribal polemic at work here against the great Canaanite goddess in changing the vowels. So what we have here is we have the same set of consonants, But the scribes in the Hebrew Bible change the vowels to an O and an E. So they get Ashtoret instead of the expected Ashteret in Hebrew. As MacArthur notes in his Anchor Yale commentary, quote, Masoretic Ashtoret instead of Ashteret is probably a deliberate misvocalization to suggest Boshet, the word for shame. Notice that it has an O followed by an E. That is, the long O followed by E in the Hebrew word for shame was inserted into the consonants of the goddess name to produce Ashtoret in the singular. The plural that shows up in the running text again here refers to local cult centers of this goddess. So what the scribes had such contempt for you know, Astart, that they actually changed the vowel name, the vocalization of the name, so that it would reflect the vowels that belong to the Hebrew word for shame. Again, it's something very subtle, but it's kind of interesting to point out that they would do that. The term Astart or Ashtoret and its plural Ashtaroth is not the same lemma, though, as Asherah and its plural Asherim. Those are two different terms, two different words. So Astart is not Asherah. Ashtoret is not Asherim. I'm going to read a little bit from DDD on Astart. Nicholas Wyatt wrote this article. He says, the divine name Astart is found in the following forms. And he gives, you know, some Ugaritic, Phoenician, Hebrew, so on and so forth, and Egyptian. It is the feminine form of the masculine Aftar or Ashtar, and in this term occurs, though, as the same name of a goddess as the Akkadian Ishtar. The etymology remains obscure, though. It is probably, in the masculine form, the name of the planet Venus, but not certainly to be seen in the deified Venus. This is indeed the case, since if the morning star is the male deity, like we have in Isaiah 14:12, then the goddess would be the avenger star, or the evening star, excuse me, as she is in Greek tradition. The goddess Ashtart is mentioned 46 times in the Ugaritic text, but appears relatively rarely in the mythological texts. So kind of maybe not a secondary character, but not as important as you might think, since she's absent from the mythological texts. Judith Hadley, who did her doctoral work on Asherah, summarizes things as follows. She writes, in the ancient Near East, Asherah, that is, Athiratu, Ashratu, Ashertu, you can go by all those spellings, in the second millennium, was worshipped from Asia Minor to Mesopotamia. In Ugaritic myth, she was the wife of El and the, quote, mother of the gods. That'll become an important thought later, perhaps. Well, to some it is, anyway. She was the goddess, the word is Elat, of Tyre and Sidon. She is Asherah of the sea. She is the consort of in a millennium reference to her, that is, 1000 BC onward to more recent. Of those first millennium references to her are found only on the fringes of the culture, especially in Arabia. So that is also important. It's not like you find lots of inscriptions to Asherah inside Canaan or inside Israel. It's on the fringes of the culture, especially in Arabia. It is generally held that the Quintilet Ajrud and Kirbet al-Qom inscriptions, and I'll mention those a little bit subsequent to this. It is generally held that in those two inscriptions that there's a reference to some sort of cultic object associated with Yahweh, and not exclusively, as some still maintain, his consort. Let me just stop there. There are a few inscriptions outside the, you know, it's on the biblical periphery. It's not in the Bible, but these are extra-biblical inscriptions that include the line Yahweh, and you could translate it, his Asherah. So the question is that a cult object that some people were worshiping Yahweh with? Is it a cult place, or is it the goddess Asherah, as though Yahweh had a wife? So we'll get to that in a moment. In the Old Testament, Hadley writes, most scholars accept that the word is used as the name of the goddess in 1 Kings 15:13, which is the same as 2 Chronicles 15:16. And 1 Kings 18:19, 2 Kings 21:7, 23:4, and perhaps 23:7, and the textually doubtful Judges 3:7. which could possibly be Astarte instead. All references in the Old Testament, whether to goddess or to the cult object, whichever it turns out to be, are uniformly antagonistic. That's an important thought as well. So when you get to biblical religion, nobody likes Asherah. What they're doing on the fringes of biblical culture, out there in the hinterlands where these inscriptions were found by archaeologists, who knows what's going on out there. But when it comes to the biblical faith, universally negative when it comes to Asherah. Returning to Hadley, she writes, the Asherah pole, again, either it's a pole, like a sacred tree, or a reference to the goddess herself, is also said to be used within the worship of Yahweh, but it is never approved. So there are biblical, this is me now cutting in, there are biblical references to the Asherah, whatever it is, being part of Israelite worship in the Bible, but it's never approved. It's never a good thing. It's always condemned. The Asherah was also at times described as being in the temple, either as a symbol in the worship, or as the image of a quote-unquote guest goddess. The references there are 2 Kings 21:7 and 2 Kings 23:6. 2 Kings 21:7 says this, and the carved image of Asherah that he had made, one of the wicked kings, he set in the house of which the Lord said to David and to Solomon his son, in this house and in Jerusalem, which I have chosen out of all the tribes of Israel, I will put my name forever. So they actually had an Asherah in the temple sanctuary. And now back to Hadley, she writes, if an image, if this is just an image, she could only be the consort of Yahweh. So Hadley's position is, if this was an actual idol of Asherah, then the idea of whoever's doing this would be that Yahweh and Asherah were a married couple, which would be familiar to, you know, lots of polytheistic systems in the ancient world. So yeah, if an image, she could only be the consort of Yahweh, even if Baal was also a guest god in there, okay, guest god in the holy place as well, because there's evidence for that too. There is apparently no part of the Bible that accepts the poles, the Asherim, as legitimate cult objects, even though pillars, the Matzevah, are sometimes accepted. You have to go to passages like Genesis 28:18, where a patriarch would build a pillar, build a standing stone to the Lord and have an offering there and so on and so forth. That was allowed in the patriarchal period, but the Asherah and the Asherim were never, you never have a positive verse about them, whereas the standing stones, you do get occasional positive references to them, that was permissible, at least at one point in Israelite religion and in biblical thought. So what's the larger issue here? Well, I'm going to quote from André Lemaire in a Biblical Archaeology Review article on this issue. I think he has some good things to say by way of summary. He says, new inscriptions from two different sites have reopened the debate about the meaning of Asherah, a term often used in the Bible. Is it, or is she, a goddess? Is it a holy place, or perhaps a sacred tree, or a pole, or possibly a grove of trees? All these suggestions have been proposed at one time or another by scholars. And he writes later on, it is well known that in Israelite religion, Yahweh replaced the great god El as Israel's god. Now, he's saying that because he buys into the evolutionary model, the idea that Israelite biblical religion evolved out of polytheism. I don't. That's what my dissertation was about, was on. So if you believe in an evolutionary model, you're gonna be looking at the data that way. My view is that this was always a competition. The prophets of the biblical faith versus Canaanite religion or some syncretistic form of Yahweh worship, it was always going on. And there was an orthodox view of plural Elohim, and there was a heterodox view of plural Elohim. Just the fact that you have plural Elohim does not mean polytheism. We have to look a little more closely than that, especially when you get to texts that post-date when this wonderful culmination, this breakthrough to monotheism supposedly occurred in the days of 2 Isaiah. There are plenty of texts that are later than that have plural Elohim in them, both within the Bible and outside the Bible, like in the Dead Sea Scrolls. So nobody's getting the memo. And I think that It's a very poorly articulated view, but anyway. If Yahweh replaced El, Lemaire says, it would seem logical to suppose that under Canaanite influence, Asherah replaced Athirat. Remember, Athirat was El's wife in Ugaritic Canaanite religion. Athirat was mother of the gods. So, and he's right here. If you know, I'm sure in the minds of some, this is what they were thinking, that we're going to worship Yahweh and we're not going to worship El anymore, but we're going to worship Yahweh in a way that mimics Canaanite religion, which means we have to bring the goddess over as Yahweh's wife. It's a very natural thing to do, you know, without some prophet or priest telling you not to do it. So that part of what Lemaire is saying here is logical. And I'm sure some Israelites in some places did that. You know, after all, you do have these inscriptions about Yahweh and his Asherah. So they're doing something that would be heterodox in these places. Back to Lemaire, he says, again, it would seem logical to suppose that under Canaanite influence, Asherah replaced Athirat, and that at least in the popular religion of ancient Israel, if not the purer form of that religion reflected in the Bible, Asherah functioned as a consort or wife of Yahweh. Moreover, a number of biblical texts seem consistent with this interpretation. In Judges 3:7, we read that during Joshua's lifetime, the second half of the 13th century BC, so he's a late dater for the Exodus, quote, the Israelites did what was offensive to Yahweh. They ignored Yahweh their God and worshipped Baalim, worshipped the Baals, that's the plural of Baal, and Asherot, the plural of Asherah. Here, the Asherot are worshipped in association with a god. Lemaire continues, interpreting Asherah as a sacred tree or grove conforms very well with what we know generally about the cultic places of the ancient Near East, Egypt, Mesopotamia, Syria, Palestine. A sacred tree or grove or garden is frequently associated with a sanctuary or cult place. But think of sacred space like I discussed in Unseen Realm. It was often marked by trees or groves of trees, you know, groups of trees, like an oasis, a paradise. That's all Lemaire is saying here. You know, this is a pattern that you see. And so maybe this is the meaning of Asherah and Asherim or Asherot, that it refers to the place, you know, a grove of trees or something like that. Maybe that's the best way to understand it. So that Yahweh's Asherah would be his cult center somewhere, again, located in the land. Nevertheless, Lemaire says it must be conceded that the references to Asherah associated with Baal could point in the direction of an Asherah as being a goddess, an actual goddess. But all the references to Asherah in association with Baal are relatively late in terms of when biblical text was actually written down. And again, this tells you that he's a JEDPer. He has that date as the late 8th century BC. So again, that's Andre Lemaire from Biblical Archaeology Review. Despite having to pick our way through, you know, those sections of his article, I think, you know, what he says is well taken. And it, you know, we would expect evidence in the Bible that Yahweh was not being worshipped properly. You would expect the prophets to complain about this consistently and to have, you know, have something to say about what the people were actually doing out in the hinterlands. I'm going to go back to Hadley here. And she's responsible for the short entry on Asherah in NIDOTTE. That's shorthand for the New International Dictionary of Old Testament Theology and Exegesis, which I highly recommend. Hadley in NODTE, and by the way, you can get that in Logos. There's no other way to use it, trust me. Hadley writes that the biblical term Asherah refers to either the goddess or the cultic object associated with the goddess. Okay, so we've got that point already. Or a cultic object associated with Yahweh, again, the worship of Yahweh, good or bad, and it would be bad in the biblical prophet's eyes. The reason for the Yahweh association is a handful of inscriptions from the biblical period that have a line in them that can be translated, quote, Yahweh and his Asherah. And is the Asherah a cult object? Or you could also translate it Yahweh and his Asherah and think that Asherah is the goddess. There's actually a third way you could translate this, Yahweh and Asherah-tah. It's an alternative form of the divine name Asherah, because of the way the word is actually spelled in these inscriptions. And we don't need to get into ancient Hebrew epigraphy here. You know, we're not in grad school. But there are a number of ways you could translate this and understand it. And these two inscriptions are the ones that were found at Kirbet El Kalm. That's K-H-I-R-B-E-T, and then L, and then Kom, Q-O-M, if you wanted to look it up online. And the other place is Kuntilet Ajrud. That's K-U-N-T-I-L-L-E-T, A-J-R-U-D. So you can get some pictures of the inscriptions and some of the artwork there that appears to depict Asherah or Asherata, again, alternative spelling of the same deity name. Now, the best reliable discussion I have found of this whole issue, and it's very long and very technical, by someone fully informed by the data, who is also an evangelical, is that found in Rick Hess's book, Israelite Religions, plural. Okay, Israelite Religions. But even, again, this discussion, it's aimed at a seminary-level audience, I think can still get too technical and assume some knowledge of Hebrew due to the forms of the inscriptions that Hess goes in. Basically, it's a no stone unturned approach that you would get used to if you've read anything that Hess does. He's very thorough. But I wanted you to know that there is a book out here written by an evangelical Old Testament scholar that covers this material very well. And, you know, is not going to go off in la-la land like on the internet and start talking about how biblical, key thought here, about how biblical religion originally had a goddess. It did not. There's no evidence for that. Okay, you have Israelites in the land during the biblical period doing whatever they darn well please religiously. And this is what Samuel, 1 Samuel 7, says they need to repent of. Okay, and other passages that have the Asherim, Asherah, you know, involved in Israelite worship of Yahweh. This is heterodoxy. It's aberrant. It's not biblical faith. Okay, so you should be aware that this resource exists, and if you do apologetics, you might want to invest in it. But anyway, Hess writes of the phrase, I'll just pull out a little bit of what he says here. He says, if this is a symbol of the goddess, the Asherah, okay, his Asherah, as in the form of a wooden pole, it would be acceptable grammatically and would be supported by other attestations in the Bible. Thus, Yahweh would have a consort. One or two of this graffiti, right away, that tells you something. Samaria, not exactly known for its orthodox worship in the Bible, had a view of their God, at least somebody had a view of their God that allowed for other deities, a perspective reflected as well in the prophets. Again, then they rail against it. My view, Hess writes, assumes that this is the personal name of the goddess. In this scenario, the final H consonant in the inscription spelling of the name could be a second feminine ending or a vowel letter reflecting a final A vowel. In the latter case, the name is not Asherah, but Asherata. This is the preferred explanation based as it is on comparative forms in Iron Age names of southern Palestine and on all other West Semitic occurrence of the deity's name from the second millennium in the Iron Age epigraphy of the first millennium BC. And I'm going to stop there just to make the comment that this is actually what Hess did his dissertation in. He's well informed about these names and inscriptions. Names in the Bible, names and inscriptions. This is where he did his doctoral work. So again, it's a good source. It's an evangelical source. If you're doing apologetics, you might want to invest in it. You can get into more details and so on and so forth. He continues. He says, Asherah, spelled as it is in the Bible, you know, Asherah, is never found in extra-biblical texts of the monarchy in Israel. At Kirbet El Kalm and on Ostraca from the 7th century BC, Tel Mikne, which is Ekron, the spelling Asherata is always found. Thus, I think the deity was Asherata, identical to the Asherah of the Bible, only spelled slightly differently. So that's his position. Again, you could rabbit trail on this thing forever, but if you ask, well, what was it? Scholars don't actually know. Was this an idol of a feminine form? Is that what the Asherah was? If it was an idol, as you know, we've had some scholars already comment on as I've been reading through them. If that's the case, then for sure Asherah is being thought of as a goddess in these shrines where you find these inscriptions. And again, presumably in biblical passages where the prophets are here in 1 Samuel 7, where they're saying you need to destroy those things. Now, it could just be something more simple as a tree, planting a tree, or a fake tree. In other words, you take a log and you carve it, you stylize it. Some people have theorized that the association is phallic, and it's an upright, erect penis. Because if it has something to do with Atheratu, she's mother of the gods, which is obviously very overt sort of fertility reference to the goddess there. She mothered all the gods, fathered by El. So if Israelites are bringing Canaanite religion over into their worship of Yahweh, it is conceivable that this could have had some phallic value. But by no means is that the only view. It could have just been a simple tree. You'll find artwork if you go out to Google. You might, Google has a lot of garbage in its image search. If you go to search for Asherah, most of it's nonsense. It's modern day speculation. But you'll occasionally find some ancient images of a tree, and on either side of the tree you have an ibex or a goat or something like that. I think it's an ibex. And that's an Asherah symbol. So, there you have just a sacred stylized tree that somebody could have carved, somebody could have painted on a log or whatever. Who knows? Scholars don't actually know what the Asherim were. So you have all these different guesses. Now, thirdly, as far as a third nugget we can get out of 1 Samuel 7, we have the public confession at Mizpah and the battle at Ebenezer. I'm going to refer to Hoffner here. He writes, Samuel was willing to call a convocation for the public confession only after the Israelites had shown him they were sincere and willing to take action to reject the worship of other gods. In verses 8 and 9, a different verb, za'ak, to cry out, other than the verb to pray back in verse 4, expresses Samuel's prayer for the people, but the sense is the same. In demanding convincing proof of their true repentance followed by intercession for them, Samuel followed the pattern of Moses in Numbers 11:2 and Numbers 21:7. Like Samuel with Saul in 1 Samuel 15, Moses also had to deal with the pretended repentances in the case of the Pharaoh. You get that in Exodus 8, 9, and 10. Despite Eli's stern but pessimistic warnings in 1 Samuel 2:25, quote, if a man sins against another man, God may mediate for him, but if a man sins against Yahweh, who will intercede for him, unquote. Despite Eli saying that if a person sins against God and then truly repents, there is always a divinely chosen intercessor. In this case, it was Samuel the prophet. Since the cross, it is Jesus, the Son of God, who intercedes for repentant sinners. No amount of time is specified between Samuel's call for a national gathering at Mizpah and the subsequent Philistine aggression toward the gathering in verses 5 and 6. Most scholars think the Philistine response was quick. The occasion will put Samuel in the role of military leader, something common to earlier judges, in the book of the Judges. So in Samuel, both the spiritual and military roles of judges are fused, which is not always the case in Judges. Think of Deborah and Barak, for instance. This is the template for the Israelite king and was the apparent plan prior to Exodus 4. Now, that's me talking now. That's not Hoffman, right? That reference to Exodus 4, if you think back to our series in Exodus, we talked when we got to Exodus 4 about whether the Aaronic priesthood was a concession to Moses, to his weakness. And I'm still of the opinion that it was. I think that the original plan was to fuse spiritual leadership and secular leadership, which you had in Moses. But because Moses was weak, God made a concession and let him have his brother be the priestly side of it. So again, if you haven't listened to the Exodus 4 episodes, you could go back and do that. But again, it strikes me as something similar here. Now, Hoffner launches into a discussion then of, various animals allowed for sacrifice and so on. We're not going to worry too much about that. I want to look at the wording of 1 Samuel 7, 10, and 11, which is kind of interesting. We read this, as Samuel was offering up the burnt offering, the Philistines drew near to attack Israel. But the Lord thundered with a mighty sound that day against the Philistines and threw them into confusion, and they were defeated before Israel. And the men of Israel went out from Mizpah and pursued the Philistines and struck them as far as below Beth-kar. And Hofner writes, and I think he speculates a little bit here, but I'm going to include it. He says, "We are not told the words that Samuel used when he called out to Yahweh for help, but we are told that Yahweh, quote, answered him. Yahweh thundered with a mighty voice that day against the Philistines," unquote. The effect was confusion and panic among the Philistine soldiers. Unlike the first armed encounter recorded in 1 Samuel 4, when the presence of the ark among the Israelites and their confident victory shouts merely steeled the Philistine resolve, the sound of Yahweh's voice from heaven in the form of thunder here thoroughly demoralized them. So let me just break in. So Hofner's assuming that this voice, this sound, is actual thunder. And that's the part that Yahweh thundered against them. He thinks it was literal thunder, which could be. You know, it could be. I'm just saying it might be a bit speculative, but it's interesting to think about. Hop back to Hofner. He writes, "Thunder and lightning on the battlefield were signs to the ancients that a deity was angry and dangerous. The military annals of the Hittite king Mershili II related an encounter between the Hittite armies and the great armies of the West Anatolian kingdom of Arzawa, in which the Hittite storm god presaged a Hittite victory by striking the enemy city with a lightning bolt. Other examples could be drawn from the ancient Assyrian texts, but the former examples are sufficient to illustrate the psychological effect of a thunderstorm on armies in the field. The Philistine reaction to Yahweh's thunderous voice here was thus typical." That's the end of the Hofner quote. So the result, Yahweh's intervention here, whatever form it took, is some reclaiming of Judahite territory that the Philistines had. In verse 14, the cities that the Philistines had taken from Israel were restored to Israel, from Ekron to Gath, again, those Philistine cities, they were restored back. And Israel delivered their territory from the hand of the Philistines. And that's not going to last because, you know, again, when we get to the time of David, which isn't going to be that far away, they're still being threatened by the Philistines. But again, at least the fallout of this battle, this is where the situation, you know, where the dust settles. "There was peace also," verse 14 says, "between Israel and the Amorites." And Hofner writes of this, he says, "These verses summarize the proximal results of the victory. For the rest of Samuel's period of ministry as a prophet attached to Israel's armed forces," that is all the days of Samuel, quote unquote, "the Philistines no longer conquered Philistine territory." So you can, I'll break in here. You can read it that way too. Even though they're still threatened by the Philistines when you get to the David and Goliath episode, the Philistines aren't taking any more territory. They're trying to regain or just generally harass and oppress the Israelites. Back to Hofner, he says, "The text does not claim that during the rest of Samuel's lifetime this was so, nor that sporadic incursions may have taken place that did not last. The point is that Israel had armies that were dispatched and given prayer support, as was the case here, by the prophet Samuel were never defeated by Philistine armies. The contrast is not with what happened after Samuel's death, but what happened repeatedly and catastrophically during the reign of his immediate successor, King Saul. The statement that, quote, there was also peace, or peace also between Israel and the Amorites, unquote, means that Israel enjoyed reprieve not only from the external threat posed by the Philistines, but also from threats by indigenous Amorite enclaves of pre-Israelite peoples. Remember, the Amorites were some of those that occupied the land when Moses and Joshua got there. God gave them rest from external and internal dangers, is the point. Although shalom, peace, and words related to it sometimes mean alliance, there is no reason to assume such a meaning here, since no evidence exists for alliances between Israel and indigenous enclaves, at least not during Samuel's lifetime. So that's an important note too. I mean, Samuel would not have tolerated that sort of thinking, that sort of action to ally oneself with the Philistines or the Amorites. Rather, the statement is that they're not fighting, they're not taking land, they're not losing land, so on and so forth, at least in the immediate aftermath of Ebenezer. And that's a good place for us to end here with this episode. Next time, we're going to talk about the issue of Israel's call for a king, because we're going to take 1 Samuel 8 through 10, and lump them all together. And I think we're going to do two parts on that. The first part, we're going to spend the majority of our time on specifically the question, should Israel have asked for a king? How do we know they should have? How do they know? How do we know it was okay or not okay? And then we'll take that into a part two, you know, about what actually happens in the whole situation. So we'll end there. And again, next time we'll get into 1 Samuel 8 through 10.
All right, Mike, looking forward to chapters 8 through 10 next time. And we want to remind everybody real briefly, please go visit our sponsor at logos.com/nakedbible. Several packages there for you to get, but we want to encourage everybody to upgrade to Logos 10.
I would encourage everybody too. I mean, just get into a Logos collection. You don't have to spend a huge amount of money to get into the ecosystem and get upgraded to Logos 10. And then you can buy things like I quoted from today, the NID OTTE. You can buy lots of different resources that will just revolutionize your Bible study.
All right. Sounds good, Mike. Well, we're looking forward to next week. And with that, I want to thank you, everybody, for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.